Welcome to the Foreign Correspondence Club. My name is Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the Foreign Correspondence Club Professional Committee. Before I introduce our guest today, I'd like to just make a housekeeping note. Please, everybody now, turn off your mobile phones. We now, as you know, put all of these up on our website, and there's nothing more disconcerting for people when they can't quite hear a particularly perceptive remark because somebody's phone has gone off. While you're doing that, let me also thank you all for coming in person. I hear of some people coming because they, some people saying, well, now I'm watching them all on the website. But it really is good for us, and we were just talking here at the head table about how nice it is to have the interaction with all of you and have your questions. With that, let me introduce our speaker today. Mr. Adil Zainalabi is the senior advisor to McKinsey in Mumbai. He was the chairman of McKinsey India up until last December. He's one of the best known advisors to corporate India over the past couple of decades, as India has really emerged as an emerging market that many people care about, that many people feel that they can invest in. And with India headed for elections now just 2 months away in April, I think there's been particular interest in what he might have to say today. So with that, Mr. Zainalabi, thank you.
Thank you very much, and I've heard a lot about the FCC, so it's nice to actually come over here and be invited to speak at this place. So it's a lovely place, and I'm delighted that you could invite me. We have, along with my co-editor, Clay Chandler, who's here somewhere. Clay? Yeah, there's Clay, who is a Hong Kong resident that many of you might know. We wrote a book that was released in November of last year called Reimagining India. And, you know, lots of... It has 65 essays, people in India, from all the big businessmen to the economists to commentators, journalists, wrote for the book, as well as people around the world. It's about 50% Indians, 20% diaspora, and 30% international writers wrote for the book. And there are 1,200-word essays, which many of you journalists will know is a nice editorial. So you can read it in 5 minutes. And the idea of putting the book together was we felt that, you know, it's a very complicated subject. There are lots of things happening in the economy and in the political economy. And that rather than depend on headlines for people to make up their mind, it would be nice if there was, in a sense, a work that people could read that would give them a very good idea of what is happening in India, the problems and the potential. So that's why we put the book together. It has done very well. It's now... the number one book in India in nonfiction, and it is number two in Amazon International Business Books. We have given a copy of the book to all the political parties in India. We hope they take some advice from it. They may not. But we've given it to all of them. We've given it to people around the world that deal with India. And so in that context, I'm particularly pleased to be outside India, talking to sets of people who invest in India and who look at India with different lenses, and hope that we can give you a little bit more to chew on. So what I thought is I'd give you 10 minutes on the book, and then let's take questions, because I think that's much more interesting to be able to answer what's on your mind. Let me start out by saying that as we started writing the book, a couple of things became very clear to us, which is it's an amazing experiment of a kind that has not really been done before in some level. India has 5 major religions and about 7 minor ones. It has about 14 language groups, 250 dialects. And if you look at the DNA, in a sense, there are many, many different ethnic types in India, all the way from the northeast to the south. And yet somehow, over the last 70 years, this group of actually quite diverse people with diverse backgrounds have, in fact, stayed together. And that the democracy that was established has kind of survived and is flourishing. I'll talk a little bit about that democracy as we go along. And in fact, it is sort of the largest enterprise of that type that's trying to do development in a democratic framework with that many diverse people within it. Just by example, I will give you the example of many countries around the world, and I'd just like to pick on Yugoslavia for one. which is a country that is slightly bigger than our largest city in India. It had three major religions, two major languages, and two ethnic types, and it broke up into five different pieces. Okay? And in our cities, we have much more diversity than that. So when one thinks about what is happening here, one must keep in mind this incredible diversity, this incredible range, and this incredible set of different thoughts and beliefs as we look at it, rather than a very clear, rather than, you know, one common view across all of it. Okay, so that's the first point I would make. Now, because there are 65 different essays, I think it is impossible for me to summarize the essays. So the only thing I can say is, look, it's a very cheap book, you know. Please buy it. We get no royalties from it, and even if we did, it would all go to charity. So please buy it, because I think you will actually enjoy the essays. So what I thought I would do is I would just very quickly give you a few themes that come out, pick on one or two essays, to give you a flavor for the kinds of things that are in there, and then we'll take questions, and hopefully many of these have been syndicated, so you might have read them somewhere else. So my favorite essay is written by a professor, a Chinese professor called Professor Yasheng Huang, who happened to be Clay's roommate when he was at Harvard, and that's how we got him to be interested in this. Yasheng Huang is at MIT. He heads the Department of Development Economics and has been studying China for 40 years and India for the last 10 or 15. So, you know, he has a unique view. And in his research, he has been looking at what is the link between systems of governance and growth of an economy, or development of an economy, not growth of an economy. And so he's been doing this for years. Now, many of you who have visited India and traveled to India know that at the back of every bureaucrat's mind and every politician's mind in India is this notion that if only I had full power, then I could fix everything, right? I'd have to go through the messy democracy and, you know, and Supreme Court and all of that. If I didn't have that, I would be able to fix everything. At the back of people's minds, they all believe that. So in that context, Yasheng Huang's essay is wonderful because it says, he looked at 130 countries around the world to look at what is the link between development and system of governance. And his conclusion is there is no correlation. There is no statistical correlation between system of governance and the development of an economy. Within a system of governance, there are countries that do very well and countries that do terribly. And, you know, it's the choices you make within that system of governance that drives it. I find that as a very interesting and powerful essay, as one of the essays that talks about it, because India's system of governance is not going to change. Good, bad, or ugly, it's going to remain a democracy unless something bizarre happens in the world. And so it's very heartening to know that, having looked across the world, it is possible within this system of governance to actually do very well. And in fact, India, when it was doing best, had its democracy, and when India was doing worst, it has its democracy. So it's the choices we make within it that work. So that's one of the essays. Let me highlight three other themes that come out. One theme that comes out, of which there are many essays, is the fact that India is a very young country. You've heard about this many times, the demographic dividend, because the young workforce is still growing, and many countries achieve their fastest rate of growth when the workforce is growing. Right? And then many countries, starting with Japan, Russia, etc., and most of the Western world, the workforce is shrinking, except for the US. So India, if those people can be employed, would do very well. It also has political consequences, however. I'm not going to talk about the economic consequences of that. In this election, there is a very large number of people who have never voted in an election before. It's almost 100 million plus voters will be voting for the first time. And how they vote will influence the kind of government that's required. Most of these people were born in an era where we had not seen many of the sins of the past before the 90s. And their aspirations for what they want is to achieve economic growth, achieve an improvement in the quality of their life within their lifetimes. I mean, soon, now, in the next 10 years, they don't want to wait forever. And this young cohort is going to change the nature of politics in India because it's such a large cohort that's coming in. And we'll see the results in the elections, which are going to be held in a couple of months. So there's several essays that talk about how the aspirations of this young group how their voting patterns will actually make a big difference in India. Another theme that is there in many of the chapters is the impact of technology in India. If you look at, it takes a certain number of years to improve education, healthcare, access to financial services, etc. But with the advent of current technologies, it's possible to leapfrog it. And let me give you an example of a couple of them. In India, in a 10-year period, we went from 10 million mobile phones to 850. It was, and in the same time frame, number of landlines stayed the same at 30 million. So, you know, in fact, we just leapfrogged the entire landline phase and went straight to mobiles. And mobiles are changing the way life works everywhere. So I'll give you an example in how even in the poorest parts of India, access to mobile technology changes everything. Just phones, and I'll come to what is coming next. So for example, if a village has a villager has a phone, he can call five wholesalers and ask them what's the price at which he can sell the rice or wheat or whatever he's growing, which he never had a chance to before. He can call a number and ask them, you know, what's the weather forecast, which he never had before. So there's lots of things you can do just with pure mobile that changes the quality of life as well as actual economic impact. One of the studies we did showed that when you have a density in a village of over 30, which is 30% of the people have phones, the GDP of that village over a two-year period goes up by 25%. Just because they're connected to markets, which they were not connected to before. So the combination of cheap devices, I think we'll get to $20 smartphones in India. Broadband connectivity, which is coming in the next couple of years, means we can revolutionize education, delivery of healthcare, delivery of financial services, and governance. Right? So I'm going to come back to governance. And that could accelerate, and that has a huge and positive effect on both the economy as well as the development of the country. So let me talk about governance for a second and how technology can change it. When you all came in here and somebody said, you know, who are you and have you signed up for the FCC lunch? You could prove who you were, right? I mean, you have something on you that shows who you are. You could say, you know, I'm John X. For 80% of the people in India, they could not prove who they were. I mean, you know, because they were named by their father as Ram something, and everyone in the village knew him as Ram something. But as soon as he went out of the village, nobody knew who he was because he couldn't prove who he was. So therefore, access to all government services, education, healthcare was a nightmare. So we have lots of migrant workers as they go to new cities or others to work. They didn't have access to any of it. Using technology, Nandan Nilekani introduced the Aadhaar card, which is a universal ID card. It has a biometric, it's a biometric card, so it can look at your fingerprints and your iris and recognize who you are once you're registered. In 2 years, he's registered, the Indian government has registered 570 million people. By next year, it'll be 800 million people, which means that every person can, by and large, prove who they are. So then they can go and say, here's who I am, according to you, and I can immediately say, you are now eligible for these healthcare benefits, for these welfare benefits, for this subsidized food, and I can deliver those benefits to your bank account right now. You don't have to go through any middlemen, you don't have to do anything, and it fundamentally changes the delivery of government services. So that's one example of how it would also affect it, right? There are many other examples. So the combination of technologies could accelerate. Of course, we could also mess up because we periodically shoot ourselves in the foot, but in execution of these things, but could accelerate healthcare, education, financial services, and governance. So that's another theme that comes through. The third thing that comes through is that, in fact, around the world and even in India, we think quite a lot about what the central government does, right? You all talk about government, we all talk about government of India and who's the prime minister and who's the finance minister and who is the governor of the Reserve Bank and what policies are there to attract investment or not attract investment, etc. And it's all central. In reality, the best innovation that's occurring in India is occurring at the state level. And the differences between states in terms of their development, how they deal with investment, et cetera, is much, you know, is very vast. And the good news is that certain states have elected people chief ministers who are getting re-elected based on being able to deliver development. The public is voting them back in, and other states are looking at this and saying, why can't I be like that? Right? And so it's spreading more from the ground level, good practices, as opposed to from the center. So that's a theme that comes out and says, over the last 20 years, this is a long-term move, as power has become greater in the states as a result of some changes in the law, but more because the central government has been giving up some of these things, that in fact more innovation is occurring at the states, which most people are not aware of, and there's more competition between states. And that actually will lead to better delivery of services, governance, etc., because the people can look across and look at the other state and see if things are getting better and ask their own politicians, why can't you do this, right? So during this campaign, one of Modi's big themes is, I was able to change Gujarat, we can do that in all the other states. Okay, so that theme, and the reason that that has occurred, just one 30-second diversion, is when India was formed, there was a lot of discussion about whether it would survive as a country. That, you know, many people expected it would fly apart. To prevent that, many laws and many things were centralized to pull things together, and therefore to make it difficult for states to leave. Today, I don't think anyone is worried about whether any part of India will leave and try and become, will secede and become another country. And as a result, many powers have been given to the states. So the states can do more and more because no one's worried that they would leave. That's just the historical background as to why that's happened. And that also leads to the creation of regional parties, etc. Anyway, so that's the theme. So I think I'll stop talking in a minute, but I just want to make sure that you have a sense that the book is neither, as I said earlier, it's neither India Shining, for those of you who remember this campaign that came out, in that everything is great in India and India Shining, nor is it India Depressing. And sometimes, both within India and outside India, we are, I describe it as Indians are horrendously bipolar. So as soon as things are going well, you know, the nation has a tendency to think everything is fabulous and it'll go on forever. When things are going badly, we all tend to think it'll go on badly forever. And so we oscillate between those two, whereas in reality, when the country was growing at 8-9% for 5 years, many of the same problems that exist today existed then. You know, it wasn't as good as people thought at that time, and it's not as bad as we think it is today. Okay, so I will, why don't I end on that note and then just see what's on people's minds and see if I can answer those questions, and I'll sit down there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adil. And with that, I'll throw open the floor for questions, and I can see one already from Edith. Please, and please, everybody, identify yourselves.
Edith Terry with Coventry Advisors. Earlier this week, the FT ran a story about India's new Mars rover, which has a total budget less than the budget of the recent movie Gravity 3D. Yes. What does that imply for the future of high technology, and especially high technology manufacturing in India?
I think can you hear me? In India, there's a term called Jugaad, which is loosely translated as, you know, somehow we make it work. And in fact, part of the reason that we are optimistic about healthcare, education, and financial services is this development of technology that is suited for India that is extremely cheap, because most of the people can't afford much more expensive. And so people have become experts at doing things like this, right? Which is, instead of coming up with expensive technologies, they will come up with very simple solutions. I'll give you two examples of that. One is, in India, there is a startup venture that has a scanner that's about this size that attaches to any smartphone, but let's say an iPhone. And you take it into you go to a remote area, and it can scan your iris. You put it on your eye, it scans it, and a doctor on the other end can look at it and tell you what kinds of problems you're going to have. That device is $10. The best such device anywhere else is, you know, in the thousands. Okay, so I think the Mars rover is just, in a sense, one example of the many such things in technology that are coming up
as a result of the boom in IT services in India, there are hundreds of thousands of engineers who are well trained in software and hardware sitting in Bangalore, Chennai, Hyderabad, Bombay, etc., who are now starting to think and do startups with these new technologies. So I think it makes it very positive. I would separate that from the manufacturing question, however. I think in terms of design of many of these products, there will be a huge amount of innovation on it. There will be many more startups coming out of India. For some of the software that drives the iPad and the iPhone was developed in India, and that will continue to happen. On the other hand, manufacturing is a huge other and different issue. Today, India, there's some studies that have been done that say that in a few years' time, the largest imports in India will be oil. It is today also. But the second largest imports and could become the largest imports would be electronic goods. As you sell hundreds of millions of cell phones a year, as well as electronic products for towers and telecommunications, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that will create another currency crisis unless some of it is manufactured in India. Manufacturing in India currently is, depending on who you look at, 18% of GDP, China is 36% of GDP. And there's a huge debate about how to get it from 18% to something higher. I think 36% is just not going to happen, to something higher. And to do that, many changes will have to be done in the way manufacturing is encouraged, and laws have to be changed, labor laws have to be changed. Today, the people who are creating jobs are service jobs, actually, not manufacturing jobs. If you go to some of the big manufacturing sites in India and compare them to manufacturing sites in China, what you'll see is the best manufacturing sites in China are desperately working to reduce labor. So what they could do with 25,000 people 10 years ago, they're now doing with 2,500 people. Nobody's putting up a manufacturing site that will hire tens of thousands of people except in clothing. That's the only place where they do it. So that has to change. Otherwise, we're not going to do... So many of those, because of the labor laws, it's very difficult to put up big manufacturing sites. So that has to change. But I would separate invention and design, which is going to happen and is already occurring, from manufacturing, which is a more complicated subject. Sorry for the long answer.
Thank you. Next, why don't we take a question over here?
Thank you. My name is Kishore Sakrani. I chair the board at an NGO called Community Business. My question to you is on the rural, the farm sector. How do you improve farm productivity? And a side question to that, how do you improve the distribution network that gets the food to the people who need it?
Thank you, actually, for asking about agriculture, because there's only one essay in this book that I wrote, and that's on agriculture. So thank you for asking. I'll start out with some trivia on agriculture, just for the fun of it, right? India is the largest producer of bananas in the world, mangoes, second largest exporter of beef in the world, second largest producer of potatoes in the world, third largest producer of soybeans in the world, and largest producer of this bizarre product called gore, which is used in fracturing, right? Oil, in the oil industry. And in the last 2 years, it exports $3 billion worth of gore. It's a gum that's used in shale gas, right? So the reason I say this is when we think about agriculture in India, we always, in general, the discussion revolves around the four big crops, rice, wheat, pulses, etc. But in reality, Indian agriculture on many other fronts has done quite well. If you take a 50-year perspective, the growth in crops in India has been phenomenal. And in fact, there is no famine in India anymore, and hasn't been one for the last 20 years. There's malnutrition, but no famine. So India grows enough food to feed itself. But having said that, now to your point. Productivity per hectare in India on the major crops like rice, wheat, pulses, etc., is one-third to one-half of what is possible in India's geoclimatic zone. Forget about the US, or forget about Argentina or Brazil. In India's geoclimatic zone, we can double the productivity. This year, I think we'll have 260 million tons of food grains. Last year was 230. And, you know, 30 years ago, it was 100 million or something like that, right? So the growth in farming has been fantastic, but the potential actually is significantly higher in terms of growing. Then you come to distribution, and, you know, there are wonderful stories, I think, including one from the FT that talked about, you know, you go around and there's lots of grain stored in open, which is rotting and rats running around and all of that, and that created a big fuss. And it should, because as the Indian farmers' productivity improved, you know, the entire system was not designed to keep up with it. Okay? And therefore, we forgot that, you know, the grain has to be transported, so there weren't enough wagons, that it has to be stored, so there wasn't enough storage. But my guess is those are relatively easier problems to solve, and we will, as long as we can grow the group. So I think there's a big effort to do it. It's still, there's a lot of numbers being thrown around that said, you know, 40% of grain is wasted, and it's not true. We came up with that 40% number, and the number that we had come up with was, if you take fruits and vegetables, because of lack of storage and a cold chain, the value goes down by 40%. So it's not that the food is wasted, it's just that, you know, when a tomato is perfectly ripe, you can sell it for X. When it is slightly overripe, you could sell it for 30%, 20% less or 30% less, right? So actually, in terms of actual grains that are not used, that actually get rotten and are not used, the loss is less than 5%. Okay, the value is more, right? Because then if it's not of the highest quality, then you won't pay as much for it. But there is a change. The bigger distribution problem is not the ability to store grain in bulk, but if you want to make sure that the grain gets to the right person at the right time in small quantities, that distribution system is not doing well at all.
Robin?
Robin Meredith and Reorient, and author of The Elephant and the Dragon. Two questions. A quick one on Nanda Nilekani's efforts on the ID cards. Has anyone measured one of the big benefits of that was supposed to be to reduce corruption. Has anyone measured whether that's worked? And secondly, would you spend some time on what, for many of us, is very curious about the upcoming election? Narendra Modi, you know, really was a pariah, wasn't at least until a couple weeks ago admitted to the United States. Maybe he will be
He's
now.
He's not been admitted as yet. She
not
only
yet,
met him.
But she visited.
Yes, yes.
Anyway.
Okay.
So here's this guy who, you know, most people wouldn't have touched with a 10-foot pole in India, even, you know, a few years ago. He has the example of economic growth in his state I guess I'm struggling with whether that is what's propelling his popularity or simply the ineptitude or lack of success of the Congress party in managing the economy. What's going on?
So let me start with the easier question to answer, which is the first one. Nandan is a very dear friend of ours, of mine. He and I I was at IIT when he was at IIT, and so I've known him for a very long time. And what he's done is brilliant, and it's not just the corruption part of it, right? I think psychologically, the ability to prove who you are, is a very big deal for a person, right? To be able to say, this is me. Suppose I looked at you and said, who are you? And you say, I'm Robin. And I said, nonsense. You're not Robin. I don't believe it. And by the way, you can't have lunch here because you can't prove who you are. Psychologically, it's a huge issue. So the ability to just give people identity in itself, I think, is a huge step forward, right? Now, this issue of corruption has, you know, many facets. And I think Indians are unbelievably smart at figuring out ways around anything. Okay? And so currently, only a very small proportion of benefits is being routed through the system. Okay. In the areas where they have tried it, it looks as though it reduces corruption by 20-30%. Okay. But it's a very, very small sample. We don't know what will happen when it scales up, and we don't know what will happen when people apply their ingenuity to get around this system, right? Which I'm, you know, having lived for years at trying to make things work, you know, people have become very smart about what to do in terms of getting around it. So we don't know the answer to that. The only thing you can say is in many experiments that have been done around the world and in India, this has the potential of reducing corruption. Whether it will or not, you know, we have to wait and watch and see, because the second and third order consequences of large-scale systems changes like this, we don't know. You know, I'm very hopeful that it'll at least do something, okay? And we have to have it, and it'll start doing something. In the small experiments, it works. So that's my first. By the way, the people, if you forgot about the systemic issue and actually talk to people who have the Aadhaar card and who got it and ask them about how do they feel about having this card, that is a fabulous experience, you know, because a woman who is completely illiterate, whom nobody paid any attention to, now has a bank account linked to that, and her monthly subsidy for fuel is deposited into her account. And she says, you know, no government ever gave me anything like this before, right? Most of the time I had to beg and plead for what was supposed to be things the government promised me. And here I get it like this. In fact, in one experiment, they deliver the fuel subsidy to the account on the first day of the month, even before you bought any fuel, which is unheard of for a government in India to actually give you money before the fact, as opposed to after the fact, which was also a problem. So I think just as I said once again, you know, the respect that it shows to citizens, I think is also a very important aspect of what Nandan's trying to do. So now coming to the more interesting and crazier part of it. Look, there's a wonderful thing about a democracy, which is until people vote, you don't know what they're going to do. Okay? And therefore, the ability to predict what will happen, you know, you have to caveat that by saying, we don't really know. I mean, weird things can happen in 60 days. The elections will be over by the middle of, by the end of April. So we don't really know how people will vote and how they'll change their minds. So you can only look at what the polls are saying and, you know, some of the things that have been picked up. So I'll give it that major caveat. That's a wonderful thing about democracy, right? Until I vote, nobody knows how I'm going to vote. The current polls say that if the elections were held today, I think these polls came out last week. So a set of polls showed that the BJP would get between 200 and 220 seats, and Congress would get between 80 and 100. If that happens, the BJP is in a very good position to form a government along with their allies. Whether or not they'll be able to convince their allies to do it, and exactly which allies, is unclear. I mean, it might, those things are subject to negotiations, and it'll change. So if the elections were held today, that's the likely direction it'll go in. But if the BJP gets below 200 seats, or it gets 180 seats, then the nature of the government it could form may not be as strong, and there may be a fight for the leadership of the BJP if they get less than 180 seats. And therefore, there are many people waiting in the wings who believe that if the BJP does well, but not as well, that Modi is vulnerable, and therefore they will try, and that somebody else might become PM. Okay? So there's at least 10 would-be PMs waiting in the wings, not just in the BJP, all over, right? And that's the nature of politics. I mean, you know, that's nothing unusual, that's just the nature of politics, right? Everyone has hopes that they could emerge as the winner. So that's what the polls say today, right? Once again, it could change. There are two wild cards that could change it. Number one is the role of the Aam Aadmi Party. The Aam Aadmi Party basically stuck into the whole issue of corruption, and they rode on the wave of very strong anti-corruption feeling among the middle class, and everyone, not just the middle class, in cities, and they rode that wave. And obviously it was a very important wave, because otherwise they wouldn't have gotten 30% of the vote. And without much, they didn't have a ground, you know, they didn't have a strong ground roots organization, yet they got 30%, and they disrupted the potential output, the potential results in Delhi. And nobody expected the results that came out in Delhi. No poll showed that's what would happen. The BJP's poll showed that they would have won enough to form the government. The Congress's poll showed that they were going to do pretty well, but not enough to form a government. And the Aam Aadmi Party came out of nowhere and, you know, basically had the maximum number of seats and formed a government. Not maximum, second largest. So how that will play across India, nobody knows. It's too new a phenomenon for people to figure out, right? So how that will play, and if they change the outcome in 10 or 20 races around India, it could matter. Right? So that's the number one wild card, right? The second wild card is, you know, every politician has the God-given right to do something stupid all over the world, right? So in 60 days, you know, somebody or the other will do something stupid, and that could affect the race. I mean, how do you predict that? I don't know. But somebody will. Who? We don't know. So with that caveat, you know, it looks as though if the elections are held today, that there's a good chance that Modi would emerge as PM. To answer your question. So then your question was, why is it that somebody like him has emerged? Was that? Yes and yes. I mean, you know, I'm not being facetious. There is a very strong, this is what the polls are saying, okay? So I'm not an expert pollster, so I'm just picking up on what we are seeing. There is a very strong anti-Congress mood in many places where they've looked at it and said, you've had 10 years to run the economy, and even though on average in the 10 years the economy did fabulously well, the last 3 years it hasn't done well, and many mistakes that you all have made, and you know, the charges of corruption, the charges of mismanagement, the charges of incompetence. Okay? So there's a strong vote against Congress. That has nothing to do with the BJP. Then they look around, and people look around and say, okay, now, are there any examples of where, even in this environment, there's somebody who could make something happen? And, you know, there is the BJP and Modi, and Gujarat, you know, Gujarat's average growth rate over a 20-year period has been very good. Frankly, it's a function of, it has done that even pre-Modi, right? But since he's been chief minister for 10 years, you know, you can kind of link that whole story together, right? Gujarat had a huge power crisis. India has a power crisis, right? We have 15% deficit, so there's blackouts and brownouts and all that stuff. Gujarat went from being 15% deficit in power to 15% surplus in power in five years. So people look around and say, you know, we've had this power crisis for 50 years and we can't seem to solve it. Look over there, it seems to have worked. He has a huge amount of support from businessmen who are just tired of no decisions from the government or capricious decisions from the government. And they look and they say, and you know, people, this is what people are reporting, right? One of the two best examples of this is the Tatas are trying to put a plant to build a car called the Nano in West Bengal, which you're aware of. They had a huge fight with Mamata Banerjee, and basically they were thrown out of West Bengal. The day that the Tatas made the decision that they were no longer going to go ahead with this plant, after a year of fighting it, that night he got a call from Narendra Modi. And he said, why don't you consider Gujarat? Come tomorrow. Ratan Tata said, you know, I can't come tomorrow, but he went in a week's time. In a week's time, the government had put together a very attractive package to bring the Nano to Gujarat. By the time they were signing the deal on Gujarat, all the other states woke up and tried to do something, but they were able to just do it. There are many examples of where businessmen find that it is easier to put up a plant in Gujarat and a few other states than in many other places. Many of them have had personal interactions with Modi, and Modi basically says, what's your problem? And he tries to solve it, or he says it can't be solved, but you know, you have an answer right away. So businessmen are backing him quite a lot. A lot of middle class Hindus are backing him quite a lot. And the Muslims are not 100% opposed to him. Right? So he may not get a majority of the Muslim vote, but he won't get zero. And that makes a big difference. So anyway, so this is why. So, you know, I don't think there is a set of people who will never forgive him for what happened in Gujarat. And they will continue to hold that view. There's a set of people who say, you know, we have to get on with development, it affects our lives, and let's get on with it. And they call up their friends and cousins in Gujarat who are Muslims and non-Muslims and ask them how it's going, and they're getting good reports. So, you know, that's how the persona has changed. Now I'll give you trivia. Can I give you trivia?
Please.
Just for the fun of it?
Yes.
I was talking to the television reporters. And I said to them, you know, you guys are completely biased. By the way, India has 124/7 news channels. So there's a lot of programming, right? So I said, you know, you guys are completely biased because you're reporting more on Modi than you're reporting on Congress. And that's not fair. And they said, listen, we're not biased. We're just we follow the ratings. Whenever we show a speech of Narendra Modi, the ratings go up like crazy. And whenever we show a speech of any of the others, that nobody watches. So what do you expect us to do? Sorry.
Okay, with that, Joel, speaking of electricity.
I'll give you a short answer. Sorry, I'm...
Okay, this will be a short question, short answer. We'll move it along then. We got
okay, because I got a preamble.
Left.
I got a... Thank you, sir, for bringing up the subject of power. My name is Joel Lakin. I'm the Secretary General of something called the IPPF, the Independent Power Producers Forum. We're global. We have members in India. You probably know Harry Dahl, or you know this guy from IPPAI in India.
Yes.
This will be very quick, but I got to go into some figures here. The big totalitarian dictatorship north of us, ruthless as they are, has delivered its promises. 1.4 billion people, over 1 million megawatts. Now, I agree with you about the lack of correlation between culture, government, and economy, but there's a direct correlation between the good life, the air conditioners, whatever it is,
for
the farms or whatever,
absolutely,
for electricity. Now, here's some figures that I find very...
Richard, let's just get the question. He probably knows the figures. He really knows the subject.
Okay. Then you know, of course, that in India with 1.3 billion, you've got 250,000 megawatts, one-fourth of China's, and that is a disaster. In America, it's 2,700 kilowatt per hour. In India, it's 125 kilowatts an hour. So when is India going to have its Sputnik moment? 1955, 56, all of a sudden, Russians send up a Sputnik. Democracy, such as it is, not a totalitarian dictatorship, spun into action, and we got to catch up non-existent Russian lead. It wasn't really there, but they went crazy over Sputnik.
So let me.
When is India going to do it?
Actually, I wish you had said Mars rover moment, as opposed to Sputnik moment. Actually, we don't want to discuss the systems because, you know, in reality, I'm an expert on India, so I really would much rather just talk about India. And I don't want any comparison to the other countries because I'm not as much of an expert on it, and so you can do that comparison. The entire power sector in India is a mess. And in fact, this is one of the things, there are two or three states in India that are in power surplus. One of them is Gujarat, which is why people look at that and say, gee, I wonder what it takes to do it. I think it's a struggle across many different aspects of power. And in a sense, it hasn't done well by almost any benchmark, even though every 5 years it does a lot better than it has ever done in the past. So in the past 5 years, the total amount of power that went in was three times as much that went in the previous five, but we still need more because, you know, there's more of a demand. My guess is that it'll take us 5 to 10 years to get the power sector to where it is reasonable. And by reasonable, I mean not that it can handle peak power, which is a problem, but on average, it can handle the average load because the government can't afford to do all this on its own. So the government started a whole series of things to do public-private partnerships. The scale of public-private partnerships in India was unmatched. We've never done it at that rate in infrastructure almost anywhere in the world. And so the contracting rules, how to do it and how to make it work, I think were things that people discovered as they went along. And that has slowed things down quite a lot. But I think this issue of solving power, which is linked to solving coal and oil and solar, is a very, very high priority for the government. My guess is that the next government will also put a very high priority on trying to resolve it. If you went in and had a discussion with the new power minister today, Jyotiraditya Sindhya, you might find, who's a Congress minister, you might find that the discussion is very different than you had with previous ministers. So I think they're paying attention to it. But, you know, look, it's a 50-year development path. This is not a one-year, five-year, 10-year path for India, as it is for China. They've already done for 20, and it'll develop for another 50 years. And in that 50 years, we'll go through many hiccups. And right now, power is on a hiccup. So we hope it'll be solved. So I don't think we're waiting for a moment. I think it's well understood. It's the execution of it that, you know, is very messy.
We have two more minutes. Why don't I just take each of the questions and then maybe you can answer them as a group. So question one, two, three here.
Hi, Rushabh Sadiwal with Bravia Capital. I think it was once told to me that India is a land of hope and nothing else. And whenever we go to such forums, people are always focused about what can improve. My question is about what can go wrong. You mentioned earlier that there's 100 million new voters in the last 4 years. what happens if things don't improve? How bad can it get? And in particular, how is technology going to affect this? Because now when you have people in the villages and in the rural areas that have access to technology and know what people outside the world have, how is that going to impact it? And is there a possibility of things getting worse?
Okay, and over here, please.
Yes, Jane Singer from The Current Situation in Sourcing. My question is about infrastructure and logistics, which in many cases has been pointed to as a big hindrance to national growth, particularly in manufacturing and so forth.
And Tom?
Yes, Tom Holland, South China Morning Post. Everyone seems to agree India suffers from a relative shortage of investment. But part of the reason that there's relatively little investment is that governments, both at national and state level, run chronic deficits, and that drives up capital costs, crowds out private and indeed public investment. Is there any chance that's going to change? Because it's not necessarily just about changing the rules. It's also about changing the whole environment, the macroeconomic environment.
I defy you to find a common denominator in technology change in villages, logistics, and deficits, but how would you wrap up?
Sure, I'll try and do it relatively quickly. So let me just start with the first one about what could go wrong. I mean, you know, look, the single biggest thing that could go wrong is India if India ever went to war. Right, wars destroy economies, and if India went to war on any front in any major way, right, that would have that would destroy the economy, and it would slow things down a lot. I think there's not much appetite for war. I think the relations between India and China are such where they've taken many contentious issues and put it aside, and said we won't discuss those for the present. Let's all both get on with our development. So I don't think the issue will be from that side. But you know, Afghanistan, as NATO and the Americans leave, poses a risk that something weird will happen, right? And Pakistan is an unstable country. We hope that they get stable. It's in everybody's interest that it stabilizes. But if it doesn't stabilize, you know, these are two nuclear powers next to each other. If anything, if tensions rise, it'll affect the economy and it'll slow things down. So that's, I think that's one very big one. The second one is this issue of social disruption and social change. If a lot of young people don't get jobs, and you know, that is a very big risk, and in development economics, that is the number one thing you worry about, right? Which is the economy grows and the benefits don't accrue sufficiently to the people at the lower end of the pyramid, and the gap gets too wide, it creates huge social tension. A lot of the, you know, a lot of the government schemes and government programs are to try to narrow that gap. So, in fact, in the last 3 years or 5 years, the government has run an incredible stimulus package for the rural areas, by raising the price of wheat, raising the price of grain, subsidies, etc., so that actually the slowdown on the economy has not affected rural India as much. It has affected urban India much more than that, right? So that is, you know, yes, of course that's a risk. You know, a third risk is, you know, just over time, sheer incompetence. You know, how do you judge that people won't make silly mistakes or do stupid things? You know, when India was growing at 8 or 9% a year, we all thought many of the things were in place, and we did not allow for just incompetence at some level, right? So that could, those are the risks. You can talk more, but anyway, those are the risks. Sorry, Matt, your question was?
Logistics and deficits, although we are now 3 minutes over.
Yeah, I know, so I'll address your question separately, if you don't mind. So logistics, for a very long period of time before 1991, even before 1998, the view in India was that infrastructure is by and large used by the rich. And therefore, our attitude on infrastructure ought to be, we will invest in infrastructure when absolutely needed. And I think it's taken some time for people to understand that infrastructure itself creates growth. So now, the economic thinkers in India and the politicians understand that you have to put infrastructure in place before. So it's no longer a philosophical argument, it is more of an execution argument. And an execution, as sometimes I like to say, almost every bureaucrat in India and every politician can say no to anything, but very, very few can say yes and make it happen. And so the execution issue is not one of people saying we don't want to get this done. It's just that the system gets in the way, because many, many people, seeing only that narrow slice of the picture, can make a decision based on that and just stop things. So land acquisition laws slowed down infrastructure. many environmental laws slowed it down, many financing laws slowed it down, and slowly we are trying to debottleneck all of it. So my guess is it will happen, but it'll take it's taking a lot longer than it should. But it is a huge deficit.
Okay. With that,
I'll answer your question individually if you don't mind.
Thank you very much for coming. We do appreciate having you here.